From WTIP News, this is the North Shore Weekend News Roundup. I'm Jay Anderson, and here are some of the stories we've been following this week.
Split Rock Lighthouse State Park acquired 19 acres in late December, thanks in large part to the efforts of the nonprofit Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. The Parks and Trails Council bought two parcels of land overlooking the lighthouse and Lake Superior for close to $1 million and then made the land available to the DNR's Division of Parks and Trails.
It's two parcels, one on each side of Highway 61, but you can see the lighthouse from the land. And one of the parcels, the parcel on the north side of Highway 61, is an area that the DNR has indicated a desire to build a campground. So it's very important to protect that particular parcel.
That's Brett Feldman, director of the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota, a grassroots membership organization working on behalf of Minnesota's parks and trails since 1954.
The North Shore has been an area where we've worked very hard for a number of years, and we're especially pleased about what we've made happen at Split Rock Lighthouse this last year. One of the unfortunate things in Minnesota and anywhere else in the nation for that matter is that there's never enough money. In particular for our state park system, the DNR, the entity that's charged with managing it, does not have available funds when parcels like this go up for sale.
The property is adjacent to a historic wayside rest on Highway 61 that at one time was being considered for condominium development.
The landowner had the potential to develop the land, which we would never want to see happen in that area. So organizations like ours, we have a land fund that we prioritize to try to be able to acquire very high natural resource-rich parcels that are critical to, you know, the future of Minnesota's park and trail system.
Split Rock Lighthouse State Park was the sixth most visited of 73 state parks and recreation areas in Minnesota in 2010. There were more than 324,000 total visitors and nearly 10,000 overnight guests. Last year, the historic lighthouse at the park, which is operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, celebrated its 100th anniversary.
In 2005, the city of Grand Marais contracted with Burbach Aquatics of Platteville, Wisconsin, to study replacement or renovation of its municipal pool. That contract now may keep the city from participating in planning a new Cook County Community Center that includes a pool. In a letter to County Board Chair Jim Johnson, City Administrator Mike Roth writes that if Burbach is not selected to design and oversee construction of a pool in the new community center, the city and its representatives will, quote, withdraw from further participation in the process, as well as participation in the community center steering committee. A reason for non-participation is not given in this or any of the previous three letters sent to the county board. The contract is exclusive for the performance of all the consulting work on the pool until the project is suspended. The city found construction of a new standalone pool would be too expensive. However, the project has not been suspended. According to Burbach Aquatics attorneys, the contract requires the city to use Burbach on any repair, renovation, or replacement of the pool, but not for the community center itself. Since the pool would be an integral part of the community center, this provision is interpreted as effectively excluding the city from participating in planning a facility built within the city, partly for city benefit. According to a memo from the Community Center Steering Committee, they intend to use the aquatics firm recommended by the architects they have chosen to design the new facility. A firm has not yet been hired by the county board, thus the aquatics designer is officially not known. If the city chooses to ignore Burbach's legal opinion, they risk a lawsuit with potential damages in excess of $325,000. The county board is scheduled to discuss the community center with the architecture firm favored by the steering committee. The city will be represented at that January 18th meeting to further press its case.
The Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation recently announced the distribution of more than $250,000 in grants. Among the recipients are two local nonprofits, WTIP North Shore Community Radio and Cook County Higher Education. WTIP was awarded $10,000 to launch its new Engaging Youth program. The program is in collaboration with Cook County High School and will bring students into the realm of radio. Katie Galatly is the Director of Community Philanthropy with the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation. She says WTIP's Engaging Youth Program was funded through the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation because the program fits the Knight Foundation's focus.
We thought it was a terrific fit for the Knight Foundation fund, primarily because the fund is all about informed and engaged communities and creating opportunities for people to participate within their communities. And the Knight Foundation, you know, the Knight brothers were journalists in the newspaper business, so it all kind of flows back to the idea about communication and informing communities and giving youth that opportunity to participate. So it was a really good fit overall.
Cook County Higher Education will also receive a Knight Foundation grant. This grant, in the amount of $2,841, will help fund Internet Victory, a series of workshops intended to take the mystery out of what broadband Internet access has to offer. Katie Galatly.
The series of workshops are really also a really great fit for informing just citizens about the importance of broadband and how to use broadband in the community. So that's really what the workshops are all about. Again, it really fits with informed, engaged communities and creating opportunities for people to come together and, you know, interact and kind of have that discussion about broadband and then take it one step further and have the opportunity to learn a little bit more about it to hopefully have it be a positive influence in their life.
The Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation was established in 1983, serving 7 counties in northeastern Minnesota and 2 counties in Wisconsin. Its stated mission is to promote private giving for the public good. The foundation has a portfolio of more than 290 charitable funds and has distributed more than $33 million in grants and scholarships since 1983.
The Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners has asked for support from Cook and other counties to make a change in how PILT money is administered. Cook County Commissioner Bruce Martinson explains.
There's federal and state PILT. PILT is a payment in lieu of taxes to the counties, something quite a few years, 30 or 40. The counties have been going to the legislative body requesting to get this money to compensate what they could be getting if the land was developed.
PILT payments mostly affect northern forested counties, all of which generally support having public lands available for use by everyone, provided there is fair compensation to the county from the state. In presenting the request from the Land Commissioners Association, County Assessor and Land Commissioner Mary Black said many northern counties are already on board supporting changing how PILT funds are administered. She said currently the Department of Natural Resources distributes the payments. The Land Commissioners would rather have the distribution made by the Department of Revenue, since PILT money is largely a tax issue. Commissioner Martinson said there is an additional reason why the county should be in favor of the administrative switch.
And it's a constant battle at both state and federal level to keep that funding in place. And the rationale for having the Department of Revenue being the administrator versus the DNR, it's less likely to be changed. More politics are in play with the Department of Natural Resources.
Cook County joins Itasca, St. Louis, and Couchiching counties already supporting the request. Carleton and other northern counties are addressing the change at their January meetings.
The National Park Service is currently developing a plan for Isle Royale National Park that will decide the fate of several North Shore families with historic ties to the island. One of those families is the Sievertsons. Stuart Sievertson of Duluth spent his boyhood summers on Isle Royale and recalls his family's long connection to the place.
My grandfather arrived there about 1892 with two of his brothers, and they were he was a teenager, I think he was about 18 at the time, and they began commercial fishing there. And the grounds around Isle Royale were very well known as being rich fishing grounds, but they were difficult to get to. It was an isolated place, and there were lots of difficulties. They mostly used rowboats and sailboats to begin with.
Isle Royale was a vibrant, close-knit community when Sievertson was a boy. He was surrounded by generations of family living simply close to the land and close to the fish.
when I was a youngster, the fishing was still hook line fishing. They would get up about 3:30, 4 in the morning and go run these herring nets, these bait nets, and then come back to the dock and do some bait processing, have breakfast, and then head out onto the lake. And I can remember those mornings sleeping on top of the engine box. And they were covered, you know, with wood box, and then there was canvas on top, and the canvas kind of had, you know, fish juice smell, and as the engine warmed up, be lying there looking over the gunwale and seeing the sun rising. It was a beautiful sight. Often the water was just, you know, dead calm, glassy calm, and it seemed to me at the time when I was a youngster that it was just sort of like magic that these fish would come up out of the deep water and bite on our hooks, and we'd catch these fish and go in, you know, in the mid-afternoon, and you know, it was just like God or Mother Nature or whatever, it just provided for us. All we had to do is to do the work.
When efforts began in the 1930s to designate Isle Royale as a national park, the fishermen, summer cabin, and resort owners who had title to their lands were bought out by the Park Service. For the Sievertsons, it was a dramatic and memorable event, and the story is part of family lore.
What occurred was one day during the late 30s, a flying boat showed up on the harbor, and in it was the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes, and Bagley, who was the purchasing agent, and they came and offered my granddad $50 for his house and fish house dock, net house, and storage shed, tool shed, and so on. And they didn't know what to do for a while, and then it turned out that eminent domain was going to be used to condemn these properties. And it turned out that by accepting a lower payment, my granddad was able to get a lifetime lease, which passed to my dad, and then upon my dad's passing in 1994, it went to my mother.
The Sievertson family has continued to maintain their property and commercial fish on Isle Royale for more than a century. But like other families on the island, elders are passing on and lifetime leases are expiring with them. They and others find themselves in a state of limbo from year to year, unsure if the Park Service will allow them to return to the family place.
I guess what I'd like to see would be some appreciation on the part of the top staff at Isle Royale National Park and at the regional level, a recognition of the importance of the cultural history of Isle Royale, and not just the, you know, recording it and writing it down, but continuing it so that people could come out and see maybe commercial fishing or research fishing. It could come to visit families out there, that families would be able to maintain their the buildings and the way of life that they've carried on out there for a long time, and that these could possibly be passed on from one generation to the next.
Park Service is seeking public comment on how to manage Isle Royale's cultural resources, and right now there's an opportunity to weigh in on a set of preliminary questions. Go to the National Park Service website at parkplanning.nps.gov/comment. This round of public commentary lasts until January 16th.
You've been listening to the North Shore Weekend News Wrap-Up. To hear more from the WTIP News team and to check out the full versions of our stories, visit us at WTIP.org. For North Shore Community Radio, I'm Jay Anderson, wishing you a great weekend.